From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. Starting today, the U.S. is banning travel from South Africa and seven other nearby countries. Canada, the U.K., and the European Union took similar steps following the emergence of a new COVID-19 variant called Omicron. Here's President Biden at the White House today.
Sooner or later, we're going to see cases of this new variant here in the United States. We'll have to face this new threat just as we face those that come before it.
For more now, we're joined by NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow. And Scott, COVID-19 rates were already going up ahead of Thanksgiving. Now there's this new variant. What did the president say today that his administration would do about it?
Yeah, he first of all, he talked a little bit about those travel restrictions, conceding they will not stop this new variant from making its way into the United States, you know, if it's not here already, but said that is a step that can be taken to slow things down so that the country can better respond. Biden repeatedly stressed that the United States is better prepared for this latest strain than it would have been early on in the COVID-19 pandemic. His message boiled down to three main points. First of all, Biden kept saying this is a cause for concern, but please do not panic. He seemed to be trying to stress the fact that the administration is taking a lot of steps and just hoping that some of those steps are not needed. It's trying to overcompensate in a way. Second, we heard something that Biden has been saying for months and months and months, continuing to urge people to get vaccinated and if they're eligible to be boosted. And lastly, Biden told Americans that if, and again, it is a really big if, we just do not know right now, if for some reason new vaccines would be needed for this variant, he says that the administration has been in touch with the big vaccine producers and they would be ready to act as quickly as possible while still doing that safely.
Okay, lots of ground to cover there. So let's go to number two, that point you just mentioned about vaccines and boosters. Here's what the president said about having more information about that later this week.
On Thursday, I'll be putting forward a detailed strategy outlining how we're going to fight COVID this winter, not with shutdowns or lockdowns, but with more widespread vaccinations, boosters, testing, and more.
So at this point, if you have wanted to get a vaccine or a booster, you likely have at least thought about it or have already done it. So what else can the administration do to convince unvaccinated Americans to get this shot as the variant sort of surges towards us?
I mean, honestly, not that much, right? The administration and officials at the state level, at cities levels, at all levels of government started by urging Americans by bribing them in a sense with lotteries and all sorts of giveaways. Then there was this big push for mandates. You have a lot of big businesses and universities, and in the last step, the federal government requiring vaccines in a lot of places. The numbers have gone up. I don't have the latest number in front of me, but it is certainly a high percentage of Americans have received shots. I think the exception to what you said about everyone who wanting one getting one already is the five and up children who just recently became available to get vaccines. I know a lot of people are still trying to schedule those first or second doses for their kids. But yeah, other than that, I think it's pretty clear here that if you wanted to be vaccinated, you've been vaccinated already. And Biden's going to keep trying, but it's hard to see anything he says at this point driving up numbers.
You had mentioned that the president was talking to Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson about contingency plans. What would that involve? Is that making adjustments to the vaccines to account for this new variant?
Yeah, and to be clear, the president was speaking pretty hypothetically about this and pretty top level, but basically saying that there have been conversations that, you know, Pfizer and Moderna especially have said they're already working on this just in case. And Biden said he would urge them again if this would be needed. And I think Dr. Fauci has said that we will not know this for several weeks at minimum. That he would urge them and use federal resources to get those vaccines developed as quickly as possible while still being safe, which of course is a very tricky balance that we've been talking about one way or another for almost 2 years now.
Tricky politically as well. The president is trying to keep the economy steady. Markets, of course, sank after this news came out. The markets are not the economy. We know that. They've since risen again. But how much of this speech was geared to trying to soothe some jitters that might be felt over this in the economy?
I mean, I think the speech was all about soothing jitters, whether that's just people wondering, oh, no, what does this do for my daily life again, or economic forces, right? I mean, there are a lot more questions than answers at this point. And the gist of what Biden was saying was the administration is ready to deal with this. So I think that was a big part of it. And you're right. It's a tricky time economically. Biden's approval ratings have really dropped in a large part because of the weirdness of the economy that the slow, strange COVID recovery has put in place. So I think another variant, if it is as serious as people worry, would certainly be incredibly bad news for the Biden administration.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, it was a tense start to talks in Vienna today to revive a nuclear agreement with Iran that President Trump pulled the U.S. out of 3 years ago. Iran's foreign minister says his country will not accept any request that goes beyond the 2015 agreement, which limited Iran's nuclear program in exchange for easing sanctions. Here now, security analyst Jim Walsh joins us. And Jim, what do you make of the Iranian foreign minister starting negotiations in this way, kind of drawing a line in the sand after a five-month hiatus in talks?
Well, he's saying from an Iranian point of view, we're not going to agree to new restrictions when you, the U.S., haven't even followed through on your previous commitments. But this is just one of several salvos all the sides are making in preparation for what is likely to be a difficult negotiation. The U.S. is making vague references to sanctions and, quote, other tools if diplomacy doesn't work. And the Iranians are demanding compensation for the U.S. having pulled out of the agreement, and they want a guarantee that it won't happen again. But I hasten to add, these are opening positions, and they are not likely to survive if, in fact, a negotiation is successful.
Okay, clearly a way to go in these talks. So remind us then, Jim, of where things stand right now. I mean, is this deal totally defunct at this point? And are these talks aimed at propping it back up to exactly the way that it was or some other form?
Yeah, it's a good question, Kelm. I would say it's on life support. Now, the patient can be revived, but each month that passes makes that less likely. Now, it's important to remember there is nothing that physically prevents the parties from returning to mutual full compliance if they want to. What's changed is the political situation. The governments involved appear to be acting more like they are going to negotiate a new agreement rather than re-enter an old agreement. But I think in the near term, what that really means is they're going to try to get some short-term arrangement that sort of holds things where they're at and keeps it from further deteriorating.
And of course, one of the major recent developments is that since negotiators last met, Iran has fallen out of compliance with the agreement, and the uranium it's enriching now is closer to weapons grade. It's using some technology it had agreed to not use. So, Jim, why does President Biden want to restart the agreement, which again is something that President Trump walked away from 3+ years ago?
Yeah. Now, on those Iranian actions, now, so far, I underline so far, the Iranian position has been that each of the steps they've taken away from the agreement was a reaction to the U.S. and that they are reversible. And here again, there's nothing stopping anybody from rejoining and going back under the old rules. There are restrictions in the old agreement that are expiring because they were slotted only for a certain period of time. But I would say the bulk of the agreement remains there, you know, and inviolable. As for why restart it, it is far, far easier to agree to something that you've already agreed to than to negotiate something anew. And the JCPOA negotiations, remember way back when, and starting in 2013, those took 2 years and involved governments that wanted a diplomatic result, Obama and Iran's Rouhani. And now we have, the U.S. pulled out, a new hardline government replaces the old Iranian administration, so it's more difficult. But for Biden, getting back to the agreement is not simply a campaign promise. It's a way to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons in the Middle East and a way to shore up the stability of a volatile region, I think.
You know, one thing that hasn't changed, though, Jim, even as the players have changed, President Biden, for now anyway, is keeping in place the harsh sanctions that President Trump had reinstated. Is that a wise move, you think?
Well, he kept some of Mr. Trump's sanctions, and he sort of added his own, so to speak. You know, at one level, I understand it. Folks are reluctant to give up tactically. They're reluctant to give up leverage in a negotiation. But I don't think that was very smart strategically. It was penny wise and pound foolish. Still, I think the real error the Biden administration made was failing to lock in an agreement when Rouhani, the previous Iranian president, was still in office and still wanted to do that. And I think he was also ill-advised to focus on getting a new agreement rather than nailing down the one that was sitting right in front of him. So I think that's where we're at there.
And, you know, these talks are between the U.S. and Iran, of course, but there are other stakeholders involved. The U.S. wants to, hopefully get allies on board. And meanwhile, they're hearing some concerns from a major ally in Israel, whose prime minister warned just today that he sees Iran trying to end sanctions in exchange for almost nothing. So what is likely to come out of these talks, you think, Jim?
Well, you're right to say that Israel opposes it. The Netanyahu and down the Bennett governments have opposed diplomacy with Iran from the get-go. No surprise there. Didn't stop the U.S. from getting an agreement in the first place. I don't think it'll stop it this time. If anything, things are a wee bit better. Saudi Arabia and UAE have toned down their opposition. So, yes, they're engaging allies, but these talks have their own purpose and their own momentum, I think.
All right. Here and now, security analyst Jim Walsh is a senior research associate at the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Musician Billy Strings is up for two more Grammy Awards this year, including Best American Roots Performance for this song, Love and Regret.
Down by the river, the water's cold. Used to have a girl, but that's all right.
That's off of Renewal, which is also up for Best Bluegrass Album. If the Michigan native wins, it'll be two in a row. He won his first Grammy in March for his album Home at the ripe old age of 28. Just afterward, we caught up with Billy Strings on his tour bus.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And congratulations. What was that like to win your first Grammy?
It's unreal, man. I've been on the road for like the past 10 years, you know, playing, man, almost 200 gigs a year, and it's made me really reflect on everything we've been through the last few years.
Tell me about this journey for you over the last 28 years of your life that led up to this moment. Like, how did you get here? Was music in your family growing up?
Yeah, it absolutely was. My dad is a wonderful guitar player and singer and plays a lot of bluegrass music, but he can play anything, you know, rock and roll and stuff like that. But it was always bluegrass too, you know. I think maybe through his grandfather or father, somebody turned him on to Bill Monroe, and by the time I was 4 years old, I had a guitar and he taught me some chords, and my dad would play all the fancy licks and I just played rhythm.
Did you have an aha moment, like, oh yeah, like I'm good, or I just figured this thing out?
I think that moment really happened when I was about 6 years old. I'm gonna paint you a portrait in words here. Little trailer, little bedroom in the back. Me and my dad are sitting there in our underwear playing bluegrass music, and he's trying to teach me chords and stuff, and I'm 6 years old. We're playing Beaumont Rag, which is this old fiddle tune, and I always messed up the chords. I was frustrated, and I just go, stop. Just, Dad, just stop. And I'm like, why don't you just play it and just let me listen? And so he did. He played the melody, and instead of holding the chord and counting to four and then going to the next chord and counting to four. So instead of thinking about it like that, I listened to what his guitar was saying. It was like, you know, do 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 diddle diddle do diddle diddle do diddle diddle do diddle diddle do. After that, I was like, okay, let me try it again now that I really got the melody in my head, and I freaking nailed it. And he was so proud. He just leaned over and like squeezed my little hand, and that moment has pushed me to this day. I mean, I still think about that. And like the other day when we won the Grammy, who did I call? I called my dad, you know, right away. Look, Dad, you taught me well.
And you know, the first time I heard of you, I saw your name, Billy Strings, and I was like, Billy Strings, that can't be his real name. That's too perfect. Where'd that name come from?
Well, it came from my Aunt Mondi, she's not really my aunt. She's just one of my mom's best friends. You know, she's the one that gave me that nickname when I was, like, just a little kid. She just said it one time. Look at little Billy Strings over there trying to play with all the big dogs. And later on, when I was a teenager, I went to visit her when she was on her deathbed, and somebody told her we were there, and she got out of bed. She come out to the garage, and it wasn't long before the guitars got busted out, you know, because Mondi always wanted to hear us play. man, it was just this crazy thing. I mean, she hadn't drank in 4 or 5 years, and she's been sick, and she's just been laying in bed. And, you know, we start playing music, and she gets up and starts dancing, and she grabs the joint and starts hitting it, and she cracks a beer. And she's like, I haven't drank in 4 years, you know? And it was just amazing. We sat there and just played all night, man.
Yeah.
And she died not long after that. And that was around the same time that in Traverse City, I was just beginning to, like, play open mic nights and stuff. And after she died, when I went up to the chalkboard to write my name up there, I wrote Billy Strings, you know, in her honor.
Well, Billy, I think Mondy knew what she was doing with that name. I think she got it pretty spot on. Why don't we listen to some of your music? Because we read that you actually spent a lot of time in heavy metal bands as a teenager, and I think we can kind of hear that at the end of your song Home on the album. Let's listen. You know what's interesting about your music? I feel like we actually hear a lot of different genres in there, not just traditional bluegrass.
Yeah, I mean, I was raised on bluegrass, but I also, you know, by the time I was 10 or 11, my dad got me an electric guitar. And that's when I started learning about Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and Johnny Winter, Yes, and, you know, Pink Floyd. And that made a big impact, especially Johnny Winter's guitar playing, you know, and the psychedelia of Pink Floyd was really interesting, you know. Like, as a young kid with a very imaginative mind, listening to the album The Dark Side of the Moon was like watching a movie.
Well, it's not all genre mixing here, right? Let's listen to another song called Hollow Heart, in which you say you were trying to write an old bluegrass song. Here it is.
I'd never settle down. Well, I spent a lifetime waiting for you while you were running around the town. You'll always have a place with me, dear, a place inside this hollow heart of mine. But it's all right, my little darling.
You know, we do a lot of stuff, like you said, where there's different genres and there's, you know, weird sounds and effects. But I like to also always have some pure bluegrass in there. Almost like a palate cleanser, I guess.
Yeah. You know, to my ear, Home is actually filled with other songs that are quite dark. For example, there's this one. It's called Enough to Leave.
Enough to kill you, enough to put you down. Seems like every way you turn is like a hard wind coming down. Enough to leave me, enough to leave me here.
You wrote that for two friends of yours, I understand, who died as a result of taking heroin laced with fentanyl, and I'm going to ask you about that in just a minute if you don't mind. But first, there's also this track called Guitar Piece. It's instrumental, and it also has a somber feel to it. Tell me what you were trying to do here.
I pretty much got high and turned on the mics and tried to come up with something on the spot. I was watching this George Harrison documentary where there was a lot of him and like Ravi Shankar doing just kind of stream of consciousness playing, you know? And I wanted to do something like that. So I just smoked a bunch of weed and tried to put something out.
Does that help you in the creative process? Because I know some artists are kind of conflicted about that.
Yeah, I think so. As soon as I would smoke a little bit, I'd be like, man, where's my guitar? You know, and I'd just go find it and just go play.
Do you think you could do it as well without the drugs?
Yeah, I don't know if it just helps me get into the mood of the song or the emotion or what, you know. I mean, there's been several times in the last few years where I did stop smoking, and I don't think it affected my music at all.
yeah, no judgment from me. I'm just curious.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I do want to ask you about something else related to drugs, and this is serious. I said before that some of your friends had died of an overdose, and I just want to see if you'd be willing to talk about that for a moment and tell me how they inspired your music.
Well, yeah, that song, Enough to Leave, I wrote that after two of my friends died of a heroin overdose within probably a week of each other. One friend was this girl who I went to elementary school with, and my other buddy was kind of responsible for almost getting me into the scene that I'm in now. Man, I was just crushed, you know? So I just sat down and wrote that song and kind of wanted to do something for him, and that's kind of all I know how to do.
Give you diamonds, give you rings and pearls. If you could stay a while with me and just hold on to this world.
Billy String, before I let you go, you're speaking to us from your tour bus. I mean, you're about to perform in Florida. What's that like? I mean, because this whole year for artists has been very complicated and really difficult, being locked up. Are you back on the road?
I'm back on the road in a sense. We're playing one in Florida where there's, you know, socially distanced sort of pods. And then when we go to New Orleans and play, like, there's nobody there. You know, they're just live streaming shows. So, like, you know, we're on tour, but we're still playing for the internet. We are doing some of those socially distanced events, and it's going to be incredible. I can't wait to play for people again. That's what I do. I know it's a release for a lot of those folks, as it is for me. Just getting able to get together with my band and play music is such a blessing.
Well, why don't we go out listening to some more from your Grammy Award-winning bluegrass album, Home. Billy Strings, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to speak with you, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much for having me, and hopefully I'll see you out there somewhere.
Billy Strings speaking to us in March before his tour resumed full swing. The Grammys are on January 31st.
Cold, cold ashes on the ground. Nothing lost and nothing found. Friends and loved ones falling down.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
We're remembering a fashion icon. Virgil Abloh died Sunday at 41 after quietly battling a rare cancer. Abloh's family wrote on Instagram that, quote, he chose to endure his battle privately since his diagnosis in 2019, undergoing numerous challenging treatments, all while helming several significant institutions that span fashion, art, and culture. Abloh founded the luxury streetwear brand Off-White in 2012 and later became the first black artistic director of menswear at Louis Vuitton. For more on Abloh's legacy, we're joined by Greg Emanuel. He's a fashion journalist for Essence. And Greg, I understand that for you, like many celebrities and influencers who are reacting to Virgil Abloh's death, it was a surprise to you.
Yes. The news was very shocking. It seemed so sudden and it kind of left me at a loss for words.
Well, you know, I can't help but be reminded of Chadwick Boseman's death last year. He also kept his cancer battle private. And I'm wondering if there's something about the rarefied heights that these two men achieved as black men that made them feel that they couldn't share their diagnoses, that maybe their achievements were fragile and a public health problem could cost them opportunities.
It's definitely times like this where we come together as a community and remind each other to really take care of our health. But I think at the same time, those two figures in particular were symbols of hope for many, many people, and specifically black and brown girls and boys in the community that have similar dreams. So I would say that holding on to that symbol of hope could have also been a reason to not want to go public with the news.
You know, even if folks don't know Virgil Abloh's name, they surely know some of his collaborators like Kanye West, and reactions from him, from Pharrell are pouring in. So what are these really megastar people saying about the legacy that Virgil Abloh is leaving behind?
Everyone that's posting a tribute has interacted with Virgil either directly or indirectly in some way, and they're all really just reflecting on his impact that will transcend time. And even still, even the things that are most evident from bringing Black culture on the runway and being an innovator in the fashion space, I don't think it's going to be overnight that we're going to really uncover his impact. I think it'll be over time and years down the line that we really truly see how Virgil impacted this space. So everyone that is posting a tribute is really just reflecting on that and reflecting on his character and his spirit outside of being a creative force and really being one that paved the way and paid it forward always.
One of the things he leaves behind is a $1 million scholarship fund he created to bring along more Black students into the fashion world. Safe to say that in some of the ways that he was the first, he won't be the last?
For sure. Absolutely. I think that's what's also coming about in these tributes. A lot of fashion figures today were given their first chances in the industry by Virgil when he was running RSVP Gallery in Chicago to one of his first streetwear brands, Bryn Terrell. He's really paved the way for it from the beginning to his position today, where he would connect with upcoming Black designers and really sharing the space and sharing the platform to make sure he wasn't the only one and making sure he left the door open after he walked through.
That's fashion journalist Greg Emanuel talking with us about the legacy of fashion icon Virgil Abloh, who died Sunday at 41 after battling cancer. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
State health officials in Massachusetts are threatening a hospital with fines as management there blames an ongoing nurses' strike for declining health services. St. Vincent Hospital in Worcester stopped offering inpatient behavioral health services in August, citing staffing issues and calling it a temporary closure. Nurses at St. Vincent have been on strike for more than 8 months, seeking safer working conditions. And now the state's Department of Public Health says the hospital has to reopen its behavioral health beds or make its temporary closure permanent. The ongoing strike is the longest in state history. But St. Vincent is just one of many hospitals around the country that has seen upheaval as a result of the pandemic. Mercy Hospital in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood is another. For many, Mercy was more than a building. It was family to many of the employees and patients who walked through its doors. Mercy was a linchpin on the city's south side, where access to health care has been vanishing for years. But the hospital was also hemorrhaging money, and new owners took over in June. Kristen Schorsch of member station WBEZ spent more than a year documenting Mercy's downfall and how it reflects the struggle to provide health care to the people who need it most. Here's an excerpt from her series.
What's this? That's my gin and tonic.
It's Memorial Day, close to midnight, and the scene in the parking lot of Chicago's historic Mercy Hospital is like a tailgate party. Music is blaring. There's a table heavy with food, drinks all around.
I think it's just pink lemonade.
Dr. Adele Cobbs, who helped lead Mercy's ER, takes a sip.
No, it's not just pink lemonade.
Stiff drinks aside, this isn't just any tailgate. It's more of a wake, or a celebration of life. A toast to Mercy, Chicago's oldest chartered hospital. In the crowd are nurses, doctors, technicians. It's a family, and they've come to say goodbye. Because within the hour, a new owner takes over, and Cobbs and hundreds of other employees are not sticking around.
It just wasn't going to be Mercy. There was no signs of mercy in this plan. So, you know, Mercy's not a building. It's the people.
She points to the building where she grew up and says how much she's intertwined in this community, how Mercy is home. But just 30 minutes after we spoke, that would change for good. This is the story of how Mercy disappeared. In July of last year, in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, Mercy's leaders delivered a jolt. The hospital would close in 2021. Ultimately, it would get bought in the 11th hour. But until then, Mercy would slowly fade away as the community it served battled to save it.
All we hear every day is people doing press conferences where Black Lives Matter is coming out of their mouth. When it counts, our lives really don't matter.
As a so-called safety net hospital, Mercy treated mostly poor, elderly, and Black patients in an area where health disparities raged.
As an OB that's serving the community, I see the lack of care for these patients.
Today's story is about more than just a hospital going under. It's a window into why healthcare is so unequal, into the struggle to provide treatment to the people who need it most.
Unless we change the underlying medical system in this country, these hospitals cannot survive because we set up a structure that makes it impossible.
Mercy has a rich legacy. It was about 170 years old and survived the Great Chicago Fire. It trained generations of doctors and treated lots of famous patients, from Teddy Roosevelt to Muhammad Ali. And so many people who work there say it was a special place. Dr. John Patterson was an OBGYN who spent 45 years at Mercy.
And back then, you know, everybody, it was like a big family, really. Everybody would have a wonderful party. So, you know, you got a chance to know everybody in the hospital.
It's where Patterson met his wife. Many employees have these deep connections. Mercy is where they were born. It's where they and their own families and friends go when they get sick. Dr. Alan Jackson was a cardiologist at Mercy who grew up across the street, skateboarding in the shadow of the hospital as a kid.
I mean, I might have a guy from Streets and Sands, Bridgeporter, who may be related to one of the politicians. I may have someone from Chinatown that speaks a dialect called Tai Chinese, which is rare. We have nurses who can speak that. We have Latino patients, and then we have our Black population. So you just see a slice of real Chicago at Mercy.
But here's another reality. The South Side is a healthcare desert where people have dramatically less access to care than in whiter, richer parts of Chicago. There's a severe drought of physicians, even though people who live here tend to get sicker and die younger. So Mercy was an oasis, but safety nets like it are bleeding money. They're losing patients. And the ones who do show up often have no insurance, or the insurance they do have doesn't nearly cover the cost to treat them. That puts these hospitals in the worst position to provide care to the most vulnerable people. You can hear how frustrating this is to those who've worked there, like John Patterson.
The reason that there's a problem with safety nets is because the people that live in the safety nets, you know. The problem is that Black and brown people are not valued. Our lives are not valued.
And when safety nets cut services or close, the people left behind feel abandoned, like these hospitals just didn't try hard enough.
I actually thought I was going to die, and I owe my life to Mercy Hospital. If they close Mercy, then where would I be?
92-year-old Dolores Wilson lives less than a mile from the hospital. She was treated there last spring when her intestines became inflamed. When the pain came back a few weeks later, she called an ambulance.
And I said, well, just take me to Mercy. They said, we can't take you to Mercy. I said, but I was at Mercy before. They said, we cannot take you to Mercy. They're closed or whatever. I said, no, they're not. I was there just a few weeks ago.
Mercy's ER was so short of nurses that paramedics for months had been taking patients to other hospitals. That created a domino effect. Wilson says she waited 14 hours in another hospital's packed ER. Finally, she got frustrated and left without ever seeing a doctor. Mercy turned down all of our interview requests, so we spent some time in another Southside safety net hospital, one that's wrestling with the same issues.
I'm Yolanda Penny. I'm the director of nursing here at St. Bernard's. I've been here 29 years.
It's mid-July, and Penny is showing me around. St. Bernard is in Englewood, about 5 miles south of Mercy.
Okay, we're going to go to the emergency room. Oh, Mr. Holland's there. Please be patient with us. We're doing a little reconstruction in our ED.
The emergency department is like a hospital's front door, but over the sound of construction, Penny tells me she doesn't have nearly enough nurses to work it.
So I'll give you an example. Tonight I'm challenged. I have 4 nurses scheduled. I should have 9.
When the pandemic hit last year, many nurses left for private agencies that paid, in some cases, 6 times more than St. Bernard.
It's sometimes debilitating where there are those of us who come in and help work just to make sure they can get through the day.
I catch up with Penny later. She says overnight, the ER was full. There was a patient who was shot multiple times, a sick baby, a woman who said she'd already been to 3 other ERs, and 2 of them were so slammed, people were waiting outside in lawn chairs. So Penny, the director of nursing, scrubbed up and went to work as an ER nurse.
We as safety net hospitals are here to serve as a community, to make sure that they stay safe, but as far as resources, we do not have those.
The struggles have been much the same at Mercy. And last year, leaders there said they had reached a breaking point. The hospital was losing at least $4 million a month. Mercy's owners tried, but failed, to save the hospital with a billion-dollar merger. So in July of 2020, they announced the hospital would close this year. There was immediate outrage. What would happen to patients if this oasis in this healthcare desert disappeared? Here's Dr. John Patterson again.
So basically, you're releasing these patients and you really don't have any place for them to land. It's like pushing them out of a plane without a parachute.
Over the next several months, it would be a long fall. For Here and Now, I'm Kristen Schorsch in Chicago.
On Friday, the Biden administration said it would raise the price to drill for oil and gas on public land. Environmental groups are upset about it. They'd been hoping for the president to make good on his promise to stop drilling on federal property altogether. But the fact is, this country still relies heavily on fossil fuels. More than 60% of U.S. electricity comes from burning coal and natural gas. All this week, we'll be trying to better understand where the U.S. gets its electricity from and how that might change. We'll start with Mark Thurber at Stanford University's Program on Energy and Sustainable Development. Mark, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And why don't we start with natural gas, which was the largest source of electricity in the country last year. About 41% of our power came from gas. How important is it to American life right now?
Gas, as you say, is very important to American life. Most places where we are around the country, natural gas is supplying a large share of our electricity.
It didn't used to be that way, though. Coal used to be king. Last year, U.S. coal production fell to its lowest level since 1965. Just 19% of our power came from coal plants. Explain why coal and natural gas have been switching places.
Absolutely. In 2000, coal was about 50% of total power generation in this country, and gas was less than 20%. Today, gas is over 40%, and coal is more like 20%. And so what's happened in the last 20 years is we've added a lot of gas-fired power plants, and we've also added a lot of gas in this country. Because of the shale gas revolution, the U.S. is awash in natural gas. And it's a cleaner power source than coal. And right now in this country, it's cheaper. So that's why the U.S. has been able to switch so quickly from coal heavy to gas heavy.
So natural gas has to make its way from a well to a power plant before it's going to turn on the lights in either my home in Arizona or yours in California. What's the state of the pipeline system for natural gas across the country?
So the U.S. has a very mature pipeline system, which is both good and bad. It means that there are a lot of pipelines, so that makes it easy in most places of the country to move gas from gas fields to end uses. The downside is that some of these lines, especially if you look at distribution lines in cities, might be very old. So if you look at places like Boston and New York, there is, in some cases, there's some leakage of methane from these distribution lines.
Interesting. So environmental groups, I know, are concerned about the impact of fracking, for one, but there's also this concern that you just mentioned, leaking pipes and wells. And I understand that Stanford's Natural Gas Initiative has been looking at monitoring those leaks. What does the future look like on that front?
This is a very important area for us to get better at. So methane leakage is a problem. In some cases, it can be a safety problem, but more often the problem is that methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. And so if we're thinking about gas as a cleaner energy source than coal, which it is in the power sector, gas emits only about half the greenhouse gases of coal per amount of electricity you produce. But you need to be sure that you're not leaking the methane itself, the natural gas, because that can cause a lot of warming.
How do we get better at that? I mean, is there anyone paying attention to it or dedicating resources to it?
There are. So part of it is technology, and an equally important or even more important part is regulation to make sure that there are strong incentives to detect and capture the methane that's being released, not just in the oil and gas production part, but all through the value chain of gas. And that's a component, who knows what will end up in the final law, but the Build Back Better Act has a part of it that would be a methane fee for oil and gas production, where if you release methane, you have to pay a fee. Also in the bipartisan infrastructure law that has been passed, there's some money in there to help clean up old oil and gas wells, which might be leaking methane.
Meanwhile, you have the White House saying that it wants net zero emissions in the United States by 2050. What are the prospects for the future of natural gas, considering how important it is to us right now?
I think we're still going to see more than any other single source coming from gas in the next decade, but the number will certainly be lower. I think it's very likely that it'll be less than the 40% we have today. And the faster that we can develop renewables, hopefully we can keep nuclear online so that we keep having all that zero carbon power. And then over time, we're going to get better with technology for storing electricity, both in the short term, like batteries, and maybe in the longer term with other energy carriers like hydrogen. So over time, what we hope is that the role of all fossil fuels will drop, but we're still going to need gas for quite some time to play this reliability services role.
Mark Thurber is an associate director for the Program on Energy and Sustainable Development at Stanford University. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And Mark just set the table for the rest of the week. Tomorrow, we'll take a closer look at nuclear power. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Callum Borchers in Boston. It's Here and Now.